Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Four Pillar Fitness Podcast and videocast today. And I'm back with my friend Lyle McDonald. If you listened to part one, you already know that this is going to be a good time because this guy right here is a lot of fun to be with and has a lot to offer all of us on a lot of fronts. He is the owner and operator of BodyRecomposition.com, a very lively Facebook group, which you're not invited to. He's the author. I don't know. Maybe you're invited to it. I have no idea. He's the author of The Guide to Flexible Dieting and the Woman's Book. And if you haven't checked those out, you should. He's a dog lover, a karaoke superstar, and an unabashed lover of spiritual rhetoric. So all that being
said, absolutely.
Let me introduce you to Lyle McDonald. Lyle, say hi to my listeners. Tell them what's up.
Phil, I don't know if I can come back from that introduction, but I'm glad to be back. Absolutely. The karaoke thing may surprise people. I had a friend get me into it, I want to say over a year ago. She's actually a host and got me to one of her shows and kind of tricked me into getting up on stage. I'm one of those people, I love singing, I love music, but I'm more of a shower and a car singer. And it was pretty harrowing, but the karaoke community, at least here in Austin, it's funny, it reminds me of powerlifting. Like, people of, it's such a diverse group in terms of ethnicity, age, gender, and if you get up and sing, you get cheered. Like, it doesn't matter if you're good or bad or if they really even like the song. And that's a big part of what she does, is she likes to see people just be a rock star for 10 minutes. And so it really helped. It brought me out of my shell somewhat. And now I'm kind of addicted because I love
that
it.
My goal
any night I sing is to see if I can sing the dumbest song of the night or just like the most ridiculous song, I guess would be a better word for it.
So what was a song that you broke your karaoke cherry on?
Well, she knew I wouldn't do it by myself, so we did the Barbie song by Aqua, which is an old 90s song that was kind of a little bit of a duet. And I actually, her persona is, she kind of performs as Batgirl sometimes, and I've always had a little bit of a Batman thing. I probably mentioned that last time. So like, I actually wore my Batman mask. It was like at a New Year's party, I forget what, maybe Halloween. And like, that was the old, and she just had me do the short male part to just kind of break me through the barrier of being in front of people. And now I love it. I go, I help her set up, I act as her roadie, and I get to sing and she gets to put on a show. And as she told someone on Tuesday, she loves not carrying stuff. So I guess I should, put all that weight room work and to helping her out, and it's all good. So yeah, I love it.
So, and I saw from some of your recent videos that you were hitting the weights pretty hard. Now I understand why. So you got to have a reason for everything, right?
Her equipment's not light, so.
So you got to keep yourself in shape. I can appreciate that.
Absolutely. It's definitely like farmer's walks, like for carrying two speakers, one in each hand and things of that nature. Definitely some grip strength. So, I really enjoy it. So,
I may have to fly down there and join you only for the farmer's walks, not necessarily for the karaoke. And folks, if you didn't know that about Lyle, it's a fascinating thing, and I have kind of followed the posts a little bit, and it's interesting that you have so much fun, and just the way you post about it and talk about it online is just it's clear it's something that gives you a lot of pleasure. I'm glad you're doing it.
Yeah, me too.
It's exciting. What's new and exciting on the fitness and other fronts here?
Nothing really. It's the same sort of typical internet stuff that's always been around, and the industry is kind of, flip-flopping from one end to the other. Is it all, I've been doing this, well, you've been doing it probably longer than I have, but things come in and out of fashion, and I've watched the fads and trends develop over diet and training and every aspect you want to name, and we're in just kind of a current flip-flop where everybody wants to do all the volume and all the frequency and not train intensely enough, and give it another few years and we'll be flip-flopped right back to the other extreme. And I kind of, like you, I imagine I've always been a little bit of, I don't know if moderate is the right word, but just like a happy medium kind of guy. Like, the extremes have their place, but as I like to say, absolute extremes are always wrong, always. And so I tend to kind of try to split the middle and get frustrated with both ends. But other than that, it's the same things we've sort of seen. One thing I know you're probably sensitive to that we might talk about is, the current trend in youth training. sports specificity. I'm sure you've been well aware of what's going on. I had a good conversation with a buddy of mine earlier today about sort of some of the mistaken fads in that. And yeah, it's just the same thing on a different day, I guess.
The whole concept of sports specificity and youth training is one that I've written about. I've actually podcasted about it, especially in the aspect of early specialization and allowing children to fall away from that broad base of movement skills into a narrower set that are necessary for success in sports. Right? It's a normal thing, right? If you are in your teens, say 15, 16 years old, and maybe you love one sport more than the others, and maybe you're getting some interest, but at 8 or 9, limiting all other possibilities except for soccer or baseball or whatever, really you're doing your child a disservice, and it's very difficult to get through to parents in that regard. But you know, relative to the specific idea of sports specificity, when people say, do you do sports specific training for insert sport name here,
right,
my question is, so that I usually ask them, so tell me what exercises aren't universal to all sports.
Right,
is it strength exercises, is it speed drills, is it plyometric exercises? Are those things not, like, are the ones we use for tennis going to be different than the ones we use for basketball or baseball or, like, help me with this, because I'm a little confused. And then I throw them out of the gym because it's not worth talking to them.
Yeah, right.
It's not true, people. I don't throw people out of my gym. Not usually, anyway. But
He asks them politely to leave and then has someone else do it.
Right. That's why I have big guys around. I train a lot of football players. I get one of them to do it. Just, kind of you mind if I dance with your date kind of moment.
Exactly.
But I agree with you. That is like, and what's weird about it is if you ask somebody about who does sports specific training and you ask them, what do you do? Like, what types of exercises do you do for your specific sports specific training? They will give you a list of exercises that everyone who wants to run does, which is just crazy to me. And they charge 50% more for it.
Sure.
And then they get mad at me because I tell them they're thieves. It's like, you know, you're stealing money. It's like,
years ago, there's somebody on Amazon I came across. He had a book series, and it was like weight training for blank. And I picked up two or three of them, and it was word for word verbatim. And he just used a global cut and paste to change volleyball to speed. Like, it absolutely. What my friend was getting at, so the context of this was Sumi Singh, who I coach for powerlifting, and she's a trainer, is working with a youth female volleyball player. And had sent me, had some questions about some testing and this and that and the other. And my friend Steve, his daughter did volleyball and he trained, and this thing with volleyball code, what sports specific training now means to them is doing the drill, holding the volleyball in your hands. There's a group out in it's called FAST. And it's like, oh, sports specific for hockey is to do the dot agility drill with your hockey stick. And to do, to put on those rubber tubing and do a baseball throw, which just messes up your mechanics anyway. And it's like they go so far to mimic. It's like, okay, we're going to do a one-legged lunge with the ball overhead because that's your approach jump or whatever it is for volleyball that they end up kind of, it's like they miss the forest for the trees. It's like, yes, I think where sports specific training comes in is addressing specific injury risks, because sports do often have differences. If you got shoulder problems, shoulder stability. But beyond that, he's like, look, for volleyball players, they need to learn, especially females have to learn how to jump and land, just good mechanics. They need to get strong in the weight room, laterally and linearly, and everything else is on the court. And something else even beyond that, I'm sure you've run into, kids go to camp and they're doing how many hundreds of jumps in practice. Mm-hmm. And then a strength and conditioning guy goes, well, my program calls for another 50 plyometric. Like, how much jumping do they need? Like, you were killing these people. So that sort of thing where it's just like, we're going to, the NSCA, God love them. They started out pretty well and I've seen them kind of go off the rails. And I saw them right one time that triceps pushdowns were important for basketball players because that's the dribbling motion. And at that point, you had so far lost the plot on what you're doing.
That's crazy.
I wish I could make that up, but like that's where it's kind of moved. It's like, and I'm sure you've seen that actually has the unintended consequence of you don't actually make them strong. They're right. So busy kind of farting around worrying about this implement or mimicking the sport that they can't actually train effectively. And it's like, I mean, Charlie Francis wasn't early when he's like, you get strong in the gym, you get fast on the track. Done. And you keep him from breaking.
Yeah, you know what's funny is that, and I think you and I talked about this last time, I'm a big fan of car analogies when it comes to strength and conditioning work, right? So particularly for kids. And I try to explain to people, so, you know, you can put a whole bunch of chrome on a Prius. It's not going to get any faster. You can put a better transmission in there. It's not going to get any faster, okay? It needs a bigger engine, right? I mean, that's why the Ferrari's fast and the Prius isn't. Prius go a long time. That's wonderful, right? The Prius is like your marathon runner.
Right.
It looks like shit, but it can run for a really long time.
Sure, right? Sure.
Your Ferrari, man, it's gonna go a short distance, but it's gonna get there in a damn hurry, right?
Yeah.
And speed and agility is the same thing. And we try to explain to the parents, you know, we run soccer speed camp, we run the lacrosse speed camp.
Oh, sure.
And there are some things that you can do that involve the implement that will actually make the child better, but it has to come later. Like if you're building a pyramid of time and skill development. And the peak of that pyramid is when that kid is the apex, right? The apex predator of the sport, so to speak.
Sure, absolutely.
That last portion of that pyramid where you're going to stick an implement in there.
Yeah.
Right? Because otherwise, all you're doing is practice. It's not training anymore.
Right, yeah.
Right? It's practice. So if my hockey players need to have a hockey stick in their hand the entire time, they might as well just go play hockey because I can't get them any better, right? I can't fix what's wrong. I can't correct what's not working and then build in what will work.
Right.
And then create some specificity on top of that. It's an interesting concept. And I don't know if you're aware, but I work with the IYCA, the International Youth Conditioning Association.
Oh, okay.
We're revamping a lot of what we talk about with our long-term athletic development programming and a lot of this other stuff, because we want to start to make people understand that just because we believe in long-term athletic development doesn't mean that we don't want you to get better at your sport.
Right.
Because that became what people would say. Well, if all you're worried about is athletic development, you don't care about my kid's baseball career. No, that's not it. Right? What I care about is that your kid plays a long goddamn time and doesn't get hurt.
Sure. Well, I mean, an epidemic of stories. And I'm actually going to make – I'll make a contrarian point about earlier specialization in a second. But, like, epidemic about athletes that were just top of the heap at 13 or 14 – and you never hear from them again because they do all the intensive stuff. They do all the top end stuff that they should save for later. So early, they're great till they hit high school and then they're exhausted. Or, you know, I've said this with regard to just general weight. Okay, fine. If you jump into 6 days a week and all this volume, A, you don't need it, but what happens when you plateau? Where do you go from here, right? What do you do next? 12 days a week? Well, there we run in, I guess, 2 a days, 6 days a week, three, like, where do you go to keep making progress if you start from a maximum? You know, you're about this too. Do the minimum amount of work to get the maximum return, increase when you need it. Don't start with the maximum that gives you, you know, no more. So those athletes do frequently burn out. Now, I will make the contrarian argument about, like, and I know what the data says about early specialization. It seems like in certain sports, and these are usually the super high technical sports, gymnastics, swimming, even Olympic weightlifting in other countries. The ones who truly succeed are the ones who start and pretty much specialize really early on. Now, most of them also probably break. I mean, that's always the danger of focusing on the successes, is the successes did it, but so did the 99% of people who cracked. And it's very easy to lose sight. But, like, I do think in certain sports, if you don't early specialize, like, team sports, very different thing. You know, I remember when I was a kid, when you were a kid, what did all athletes do? We did it all. Even at the high school level, you play football in the fall, you would play basketball in the winter, and you play baseball in the spring, or you'd switch to track. And, like, I maintain that America invented multi-sport training long before the Russians thought about it. Because that's just what, if you were a good high school athlete, you did it all. So you could get letters, and let's face it, so you could get girls.
Well, yeah, of course.
That's what, you know, and so I do think in certain of then again, I mean, the Bulgarians were notorious, and who's the gymnastics coach? You know, Bella
Corbett. Oh, gosh, Olga Corbett's coach, right? That guy?
Yeah, like, and he was a maniac, and he brought the child abuse level. He created champions, but he probably broke 99% of them. So yeah, within the American system, though, I think there's this push. So many parents see their kid's athletic career as kind of, I mean, it's like winning the lottery. If your kid becomes a pro, you're set.
And that's such a twisted view of it, right? In so many ways, but it's supported by all of what they see in the media. I mean, it's supported by the mainstream media is perpetuating this idea that every kid has a shot to be a professional athlete. When the reality of it is, probably the same percentage of kids that get to the pro level are the ones who are born with the nascent ability.
Oh, sure.
Over and above their peers, right? So they're those kids who at 5 years old have the visual and motor arc to be able to catch a baseball with a bare hand when everybody else is putting their gloves up to defend themselves, right?
And absolutely.
I did a video about this for the IYCA talking about, you know, this is the time of year when dads walk in and ask us, can you help my kid's velocity? And he's eight, right? Can you help my kid catch and throw better? You know, and he's six. And I hate to have to explain it to parents, but there are neuromuscular and neurobiological limitations and how good your kid is going to get up to a certain age, right? And then things mature and then they become, you know,
sure,
as good as their peers, right? So there's this worry for a lot of us and this concern for a lot of us, and talking specifically to your gymnastics model, because I think it's a good one. So yes, kids get broken into gymnastics, kids get successful in gymnastics.
Yes.
The thing that I would love to see, and I don't know how we get there, is how do we give more of those kids a positive experience, even if they don't get to the top?
Yeah.
And not have them burn out at 12 or 13 years old.
Oh, absolutely.
Completely away from fitness ever. Like right. No physical activity because it's confrontational to them. It makes them feel bad, whatever, right? I don't think either you or I have that answer right here.
Yeah.
But that is one of those societal questions that we need to answer if we're going to allow the sports that requires early specialization to continue to have it.
Sure.
You know, otherwise we're really hurting a large number of children, and that's bad news.
Sure. And I think we also forget that, I mean, if you look really swimming was always unique. Swimming just tended to be kids like to swim, but it doesn't break people like other sports because it doesn't have the impact, doesn't have the dietary horrors of gymnastics. You know, we look to the Eastern European countries, and they do all that and don't care how many they break. I mean, China is sort of like, there's horrible videos. It is child abuse. But when their only goal is the Olympic stage to prove political ideologies, they don't care. And America, we weren't based around that. But now, again, like you said, when this is the only end criteria is either pro contract, millions of dollars, gold medal, nothing else matters anymore.
Right.
It's not about, you know, and you even look at the great coaches like the John Woodens, the Bill Bowermans, who said, I'm not training athletes because you're only being an athlete till your 20s. I'm raising, well, this will sound sexist. He was dealing predominantly with male athletes. This was the same. I'm raising men. I'm trying to give you lessons that will help you later in life because you're not going to be an athlete forever. There's one of my favorite books called Gold in the Water, and it's about the swim team out in California. Highly recommend it to anyone. It's a fantastic book. It follows this specific team, a Santa Clara swim team, on their Olympic goal. And their coach, who's an old school taskmaster who builds champions, told him, he goes, look, I've sent 27 men to the Olympics. Of those, a handful of them won a gold medals, and the others didn't win medals, but they're millionaires now. And it's like, because I was, you know, at the end of the day, this is great, but only one out of 10,000 is going to get there. So it's like, if that is your only goal in life, like, you're probably gonna be disappointed. And sort of asking them, like, what's the goal here? I am teaching you lessons that will help you later in life about focus and consistency and dedication, this and that and the other. But yeah, so it's become that such an end goal, and now there's more competition, and the parents have gone nuts. Because it's like, okay, I got to have my kid in. The only way that they're going to be a great high school player, make it to college, make it to the pros, is if I am just torturing them at age 12,
right,
or whatever, well, you know, whatever it is. And it is really the parent. I mean, and of course, we are a capitalist society, for good or for bad. Companies will happily take their money and go, we can do it. I can make your kid a champion if you pay me enough money per month to give them sports-specific training that does them no good whatsoever. And, right, and the great athletes are there doing the basics and practicing their sport and having the genetics. So, I mean, you and I, old men shouting at clouds, but we're on the same page.
Well, it's interesting. And you know, it as sort of a take a slight turn off of this conversation, but the same neighborhood, So you just hit on something very interesting, right? I had a conversation just the other day with one of our dads, one of the dads of one of my kids who trains here, and his kid comes in and does the work.
Yeah.
Does everything we tell him to do. When he's banged up, he does everything we ask him to do, and he gets healed up and he goes back to work. Well, the kid's put on, he's a little kid. He was adopted by this family. He's Asian. And he came in weighing like 90 pounds. He's a soccer player. Was constantly getting knocked off the ball. He's a high school. He came in eighth grade. Now he's a freshman in high school. Now he'll be a sophomore this year. He was getting knocked off the ball constantly. Couldn't stay on the field. Was all banged up. He put on 30 pounds.
Wow.
Just came back from an ID camp at Wake Forest, mm-hmm. where he was going up against seniors and juniors at Wake Forest, college seniors and juniors. He's a high school sophomore. And the Wake Forest coach comes over to his dad and says, you know, is that your son? He says, yeah. He says, I'm really impressed. Like, we're going after him, and he's holding his own. Now, all this kid ever did, Lyle, is he does ball work on his own.
Yeah.
So footwork on his own. He comes in here. What am I doing today? What do you want me to do? What, you know, give me my structure. Okay, let me go to work. Puts the work in. Okay. That's what happens. When the boring stuff works, you become a better athlete, right?
Yeah.
A kid who's playing in the Coyotes organization in the NHL. He's going to wind up playing in the NHL, this kid. Okay. Right. You know, the one thing, and I said this to the same dad, the one thing this kid has never asked me for in the 4 years that I've been working with this kid, more variety.
Yeah.
Or hockey specific training.
Yeah.
Ever. Not one time. Okay. Puts the work in, does what he's supposed to do. Scored an 18 out of 21 on the FMS at the NHL Combine.
Wow.
Okay. Right. I mean, just sick amount of work, and is always a positive influence. Just gets the stuff done. He's a leader in the gym.
Yeah.
And I know he's going to wind up as a leader on the ice. And again, it's not about me. These kids come in and do the work.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the thing, that, you know, mom and dad aren't looking for the next ooh shiny exercise. But not looking for the next ooh shiny, you know, power skating instructor.
Right.
They stick with people that they know will give their kid what they need. But again, the kid puts the friggin' boring work in on a constant basis. And that's, you know, and if you're listening to this podcast or this video cast right now, boys and girls, I know without even asking, I know that if I ask Lyle right now, what's the formula for success in pick a sport, pick an activity, weight loss, powerlifting, baseball training, whatever, he's going to probably say consistency, effort, and dedication.
Yeah. I mean, make no mistake, it helps to have a good training program. But I remember, and this goes to your comment about buying in, I forget who said, Steve Plisk, he was a strength coach of some renown years ago. And he, you know, he worked with all kinds of teams. He said, you know what, we've tried every periodization scheme, every training, everything you care to name. He goes, hard work on a suboptimal program beats mediocre work on the best program in history. Because at the end of the day, you know, you and I know you can get there by different paths. There are relatively better and less, but the guy who's putting in the consistent day-to-day work on the quote unquote less than and especially unsexy program, mm-hmm. will still succeed over the guy who's either, you know, and you see this with athletes too. Ah, my coach, I'm not getting better this month. I'm going to go to the speed guru. I'm going to go to the strength guru. I'm going to go to this guru. And he's got the secrets. And it's like, no, I'm going to go find a new coach with a different. And sometimes that's necessary, but usually it's an athlete, you know, sort of looking for secrets. And the secret is consistent hard work over time. And I bet if you look at, you know, I listened to a great podcast, there's interviews with like five, I think they were all performance coaches. Don't swear me to that. But one of them was actually Michael Phelps' coach. And he talked about the role of consistency. And he said, Michael Phelps has been doing the same warm-up since he was 8. That's it. That is how, and it's, you know, and part of it, and I'm big on this in the gym. Like I want in powerlifting, I tell the lifters, I go, every good athlete has a routine that they do, and different athletes do different things. Like go watch the great basketball players, the great free throw shooters. You could watch 100 different free throw shots, and everything they do is robotic because that is their process. From step one, once they've started it, they have just trained the robot to do what it needs to do, and they're not thinking. And so it's like, yeah, the same coach is like, when we travel, we have a light workout we do to kind of reset our body rhythms. The athletes don't even ask. They know that when we arrive, they go to the hotel, they go to the pool, they do what they need to do. And I bet if you look at all of the great athletes, they all did essentially that. You know, I used to see that when I was speed skating, watch any the best athletes in the world go through the same meticulous, focused warm-up day after day after day, and they've been doing it for 20 years. Because every rep, even if they are perfect, is still another good rep. And it's boring, it's not any fun, but that's what works. Right. And I would even go so far to argue, and then I'll hush. One question I've seen come up, like, and maybe, actually I'll ask you this. Can you teach dedication or motivation? If you have an athlete that walks in and just doesn't have it, is that something that you as a coach, can you teach that?
I think largely no. I think you can draw it out of people who've had it suppressed, right? Or okay. Who've had some failures and got beat up and they're feeling a little bit, you know, they're not capable, right? So you can inspire some people. You can give them a fresh reason for things. I think you can draw motivation out of someone. Dedication, on the other hand, that requires a long-term commitment to success.
Yeah.
And I think for most people, most human beings, you're either born with that capability. And I think, to be fair, Lyle, I think most people are born with it. Okay. I think most people they're capable of sacrificing in the short term for long term or even medium term gain.
Okay.
You know, realizing that if they don't take that immediate gratification right now, they'll be a better version of themselves tomorrow. Right.
Yeah.
And they can understand that, right. Maybe they haven't had the lesson taught to them or had it actualized for them in real life.
Sure.
I think everybody's capable of it, but I think if they don't have it, I tend to agree with you. I don't think if they don't have it and they're not exhibiting it now and you can't draw it out of them.
Yeah.
It ain't gonna work, man. Like they're just not going to get it. It's not going to come from the stars. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Cause that's an occasional argument. Like you'll see that online, right? It'll be like, oh, there are no genetics to any of this, which is untrue, provably untrue, but there is only dedication. And I've raised the question, but what if the tendency towards being dedicated or not has a genetic component? And this seems to be something that we forget. Behavior, I mean, it is, when I've ever looked into this, you know, human behavior patterns are maybe half genetic. We all have our inherent tendencies, but they are malleable. And certainly, I think you're absolutely right. Early exposure to things, early experiences can make all the difference in the world, you know, and it can, you know, which is for, on the one hand, you know, if a kid, I've known people that had parents who were not the best, who would almost punish them at random. And if they did something good or something bad, if the parent was in a bad mood, and like, what have they learned? None of my actions have any meaning on the outcome. Right? Because why would you? Why would you believe that they did? No matter what you do, you're going to, you know, if you were the good kid and you still got punished for it, that's the lesson that you learned. It seems like, certainly, I agree with you completely, you can absolutely quash motivation. If a kid does something that is good, like, you know, for their, or whatever it is, to not give them some sort of positive feedback is basically, why would you keep going? But the other extreme, if you give them over positive feedback when they have really accomplished nothing, that can become equally bad, right? It's the difference I've said between being confident and cocky. Confidence is based on accomplishment.
Right.
Cockiness is based on false belief.
Yes, I agree.
And I think you can absolutely build confidence. And again, I'm believing this with beginners especially, but even with athletes. You have to give them more success. With a beginner, I want it to be 100% successful. Even if I have to game the system to make, you know, I'll start them lighter than they should. Second workout, hey, you've made improvement. That's all I care about.
Right.
Especially people that have had bad exercise experience, to your point, they've just failed. You have to reteach them that, look, you can do this. And even with athletes, it shouldn't always be there. But what's the old saying? Failure begets failure. If every time they do something, or the old punishment model, you had a bad game, go run laps for an hour out of punishment. No, that's, maybe you should just take a step back and address why they lost. And fit, you know, I used to see speed skating coaches do that. Oh, you had a bad, and it was funny, if you had a bad race that was 12 laps long, they would make them say a hard 12 set punishment series.
Enough, which is a problem.
Right, because probably the reason that they skated badly is that they were fatigued from giving them too much training to begin with. And I'm just like, how does, you know, how does that? I always try to set people up for success in the aggregate, because every time it happens, they go into that next task going, I can do this. And in believing that, assuming as a coach, I've done my job of not giving them an impossible task, that just builds success upon success upon success. So I agree with you. I think it is part genetic, but you can definitely destroy it just as you can bring it out to a degree. Yeah. I do think the great athletes, there's something you do. You have to be willing to put in the boring work.
Yep.
And it is, again, this Gold in the Water program, it's actually a swimming book I read that I would never recommend because it's incoherent or it's incomprehensible. And there are guys like, because swimming coaches, they'll do 1,000, so many variables, you can give 1,000 different sets. So like some athletes will go an entire season and never swim an identical workout. And the coach said, the goal of training is not to keep the athlete entertained.
I agree.
Just to keep them better. Now, I do think the boredom factor does hurt some people. You have to give them a little variety to keep them interested in the process. The goal is not fundamentally to entertain them. It is to set up workouts to physiologically improve them.
I actually heard the phrase, and I can't say because I don't remember where I heard this, but it was definitely a strength coach who said it, because I remember the setting and I remember when it was said. Progression is variety. So
yeah,
when you progress somebody, say from a bilateral to a unilateral exercise, you've created variety, right? So
yeah. The
variety of stimulus, you need to present it that way. Present it as, hey, we're going to do a variation here, and let them understand that, right? So you keep the boredom factor at bay a little bit that way, I think. But it's interesting that you know, talking about reward and punishment in sports. I see it with parenting, right? And I don't really want to get too deep in this conversation, but into this part of the conversation. But I see, you know, that random punishment or improper punishment or improper reward. And on the one hand, you're creating a little psychopath. On the other hand, you're creating a little sociopath. If your path is any good, right? I mean, it's not good. We're either going to be taking care of
this in a while. That's okay.
A little shit the rest of our lives, or we're going to have to imprison this one, right? So anyway, moving on. I thought that was seemed relatively amusing in my head. So,
but it's absolutely true. I mean, the only time I've told Sumi this repeatedly, I'm like, the only time I will ever get mad at you in the gym, like I will never get mad at her for failing a task, because as much as anything, that means that it's usually a program. Like that's usually my fault. Said I will get angry if you give up. And that's really, that's what it takes a lot. Like, yeah, if you disrespect the equipment, if you get angry and throw it like that, that will get you. Because I very early had a martial arts instructor and I learned a lot of respect for the dojo, so to speak. You just weren't allowed that sort of thing. And I'm like, but it would, like, if you give it your best and it didn't go, that's still your best. Like, again, that's probably my fault for misloading or making it. Usually now when she misses a lift, it's because I don't trust my gut and I put more weight on the bar because I want it more than she does. But yeah, as long as she gives me 100%, I'll be happy and she's consistent. But I'm not going to punish her for missing something, you know, unless, again, she quit.
You just hit on something that we see in sports coaching a lot, right? So a team loses a game because they were either a mental error, okay, mm-hmm. A physical skill error, right? Not a conditioning thing, but a physical skill error. And the next day of practice, they get punished with running or push-ups or something like that. And I had the opportunity to ask a lacrosse coach about 5 years ago. He had this habit of making his guys run holding a telephone pole overhead when they lost games.
Okay.
And I asked him, like, what lacrosse skill are you reinforcing there?
Yeah.
Like, what area of lacrosse skill that was missing during the game you lost are you reinforcing by crushing your kid's shoulders?
Yeah, right.
So, and he looked at me, he's like, what do you mean? I said, what part of the question didn't you understand? What lacrosse skill are you reinforcing? It's simple. It's a simple question. I'm a strength coach. You're a lacrosse coach. If they lost a game because they didn't know how to do something, why aren't you running?
Right.
Of them.
Yeah.
And he looked at me, he's like, I never thought about it that way. And then he changed nothing. Well, he changed nothing, Lyle. And 2 years later, his entire varsity team walked out on him before a game in the middle of the season and said, we're done. We're out.
Which is probably the best thing they could have done. I mean,
he was killing them. They were a bunch of them were our clients, and they were coming to us. They had shoulder problems and hip problems. Yeah. They were just a mess. But yeah, that was one of the more interesting responses I ever got from a coach. But it was fun. So next up, boys and girls, I'm going to ask Lyle about two of his favorite researchers in the world. And we're going to see how that goes. But first, we're going to pause for a moment for a word from our sponsors. Hey, welcome back to the podcast, folks. We're here with Lyle McDonald, one of my favorite guests, and one of my favorite people to read online, period. Interesting guy and a big fan of A Spirit of Rhetoric, as I've said earlier. So I see that you have a, is it fair to say, another spat going with Schoenfeld and Krieger?
I don't know if it's another. It's just a continuation of the old one, which was, you know, this has been going on for about a year now, and I am nothing if not, let's call it tenacious, to put it politely, vindictively obsessive is probably a little bit closer to it. Yeah, and the long and the short of that, a paper came out last year by Brad Schoenfeld about training volume. And let's just say that I had some concerns with it. And I've written about this extensively and ranted and raved about it. And as so often happens, and this is endemic to the field, I've dealt with it for 20 years. It's funny, people have always liked the fact that I'm kind of a critical asshole, until I'm a critical asshole of them. And it's funny how all of a sudden my criticism is suddenly invalid, comes from nothing, is based on an agenda or a bias or whatever. And it's like, so basically you can criticize other researchers for poor methodology, but you are above that yourself. And I have a problem like that on any with anybody, including myself. Make no mistake, I look back at the way I acted when I was younger, and as a boy, I thought, admitting that you're wrong is a sign of weakness. And then as you grow up and become a man, it's hopefully at some point, you're realizing that being able to admit that you're wrong is a sign of strength. And so I'm not saying I'm above that, or that I was never did that, or I probably do it from time to time now. I'm not even remotely thinking I'm any better than that. But when someone makes a career on supposedly doing good science and being critical, and you point out an error, and they make nothing but excuses and just ban and block anyone that criticizes them, that just puts them into the guru camp. And I have a real problem. And people go, "Oh, you block people." Yeah, I do. And I kick people out of my Facebook group for being stupid, or like, not if you question me and I can't answer your question, I'm wrong. It's just that simple. If I can't provide my backing evidence, then I'm wrong. And so that all came up, and everyone, you know, and there's sort of a little crew of folks that are all in the same circle, and they kind of circled the wagons, which is what always happens in the situation. And it's just like, I would be fine if they would address it, if they would address the criticisms meaningfully instead of making smoke screens and excuses. And I just, that's BS, because I've seen him demand similar responses from other researchers. And if they don't, then other research. But, you know, what's good for the goose is clearly not good for the gander. And what this all came down to was this training volume study that was just completely out of line with all the other research, right? All the others, well, there was most six out of eight of the studies. But rather than addressing the limitations or the mistakes or any of the errors, everyone involved just made excuses. The statistics, I'm not going to get into that boredom, didn't support the conclusions. And their statistician basically made similar excuses. He's made a claim that a reference exists that supports something, and he's yet to provide it. And some would call that a misspeaking, and I would call that a lie, because I've seen that for 25 years online. Oh, well, I've got proof that this occurred. Show me. Oh, I don't have time to argue with you on the internet, since that's all you have to do all day. Then just admit you're full of crap, right? If you're going to claim, and of course, when I bring these things up, I'm the one in the wrong. It's phenomenal. Now, part of that is because I've made myself an easy target. I spent 20 years being, let's admit it, kind of an asshole online. And I took responsibility. I think we talked about that last time. I took responsibility for that in 2014. And, you know, I was dealing with some mental health stuff, and I've gotten treatment, and I've tried to do better, with relatively better and worse success, depending on what kind of mood I'm in and how much sleep I got. I can still be a little reactive. But because of that, I'm easy to dismiss. And I'm sure you run into this too, people, and this is societally true. This is true in politics. It's true in every field. People will trust someone who's nice, even if they're basically misrepresenting something, over someone that's an asshole. And I'm easy to dismiss, and I'm an easy target because of that. But when I'm saying, look, I want to see this reference you claim exists, and I go, if anyone else did this, you would be all over them. And I don't like the hypocrisy of it. Like I said, if you come ask me, if I make a claim and you go, let me see the research, I can usually find it within about 30, because it takes less time to provide the proof than to make the excuses. And, you know, and again, even as more research comes out and it's like showing that this is the one anomaly, like, okay, science is built on a model of evidence. If the majority of studies say one thing, this one is probably incorrect, or the model is incomplete. But again, so I don't want to get too deep into this. You can go to my website. I've been ranting and raving about this for a year, and I'm still just waiting for, okay, you made this claim. It's not true. Why am I in the wrong for bringing it up, other than you just get it? So nothing will be resolved. At the end of the day, I'm probably just bringing them more publicity than I am doing harm to it. But this is what I've done my whole career, because people early on were like, what's your agenda? What's his? It doesn't, this cuts both ways, right? My agenda is the same as it always has been, being critical of what I think is bullshit in this industry. But because you like him and don't like me, which is fine, but say that. Just go, look, I like him and I think that's cool. Show me the intellectual honesty to just tell me why you're going to play all these little games, right? Because when I asked them to defend this in my Facebook group, they just left and blocked me. They were above having, again, the responses they would demand from anyone else. They did not, or they were able to give them in a place where I didn't, there was, you know, I and others couldn't respond. They've done this repeatedly. People that have questioned the teachings just get booted. And that's guru behavior. And I don't think that's appropriate from anyone. So that's what's going on there. And I'm, like I said, at this point, people should know how I am about this stuff. I don't let stuff go. I truly don't. And that's probably not healthy, I'll be honest. It's probably not my best character trait.
Well, I think in a case like this, though, you're not, it's not a question of whether, you know, it's not like you're staying on something just to be vicious or to be confrontational. You're questioning a scientific method. And I think, I read your article about it.
Yeah, you missed it.
Briefly read over as much of the information as I could find online. And I don't understand everything about the methodology that you're questioning, and that's okay, right? I get what you're saying. I get the whole idea.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, right? Methodology is methodology, and there are ways to design studies to make sure that they work and ways to design studies to make sure they don't work.
Right.
And if we're going to design poor studies and then claim that the results are fact, that's a problem, right? And I agree with you completely on that. I think don't let it go, because I think eventually, hopefully,
I'm listening.
But in, had to zip off and take care of the dog.
Yeah, I love a dog.
that was awesome. I'm leaving that right in the video portion.
Be glad I was wearing pants, because I did a podcast years ago and I was just in shorts or something, and they were like, we'll edit that out. Like, okay.
All good. Lyle's back. The dog's out. They're all good.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on. I don't think you should let it go. I think it's important to hold researchers to account. Otherwise, the research is really worthless when it comes right down.
Yeah, and that's just really it. It's just like, if you're going to hold others to a certain standard, then hold yourself to that one. And there was one particular methodological issue that I had. And when I brought this up, Brad's response was literally, you can trust me. To which I ask, does that mean we can't trust the others? Are you telling me, basically what you're saying is that you are above what is considered a basic aspect, which has to do with being the scientists being blinded to the measurements, so they don't know who's in which group. And you're basically, your response to not doing this correctly is, you can trust me? This is just, no. And then it became, well, Lyle never brought up blinding before this, which has got nothing to do with anything, right? That's the man on trial for drunk driving. And like, well, others drive drunk. Why are you not Braid Scott? Because they're not part of this. This isn't about them. And now, of course, every time I do a research review, oh, I bring it all up. I will be absolutely, because again, consistency. If I'm going to hold them to the standard, I'm going to hold every study I look at from here on out to the identical standard. But whatever. It's a lot of excuse making. It's a lot of stuff that I'm just like, I just show me. If you're going to claim this book exists, it takes you 10 seconds to send it to me, and it's been a month since I asked. So either admit that it doesn't exist or send it. It's just that simple. All right, moving on.
So anyway, the long and short of all this, folks, and for you all folks listening at home, is if you haven't read some of Lyle's research reviews and you are interested in science, he does a fantastic job of breaking things down, and he doesn't always pick on people, so it's okay.
Not always.
Not always. So moving on, let me ask you a question. So you probably saw the story that came out, I don't know, maybe a month or two, month and a half ago, about the Instagram influencer who was failing to give people what they paid for. I'm curious because I love your take on some things. Give my listeners and our viewers your thoughts on the whole influencer movement in fitness.
Yeah, I mean, I actually don't know if I remember that specific story, but I don't think it has to be a specific one for that. I mean, on the one hand, it is certainly frustrating. Like, it's like we are having people that are, you know, just using their influence to sell ads. But on the other hand, is this any different than what's existed for the last 50 years? It's just the newest technological version of it, of getting celebrities to say, I use this product. I mean, if people, I don't know what the age of your podcast listeners are, but, you know, go back to the early 40s and 50s when celebrities were able to go, I smoke Marlboros because it may, you know, that was early influencing. In the fitness industry, in the health industry especially, people have always just plied on their appearances and looks. I mean, the muscle magazines have sold supplements based on, I guess, the influence of, you know, basically steroid-using bodybuilders who have been big for 10 years and said, this supplement is what did it for me. So on the one hand, I don't know that I see it as necessarily being different from anything that's come before. It's just a different version of poor advertising and marketing. But it's also reached a new level of deception and maybe just reach. I don't know if are you familiar with the Fyre Festival debacle that happened 4 or 5 years ago?
Yes, I am. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and if anybody wants to look, basically this was a guy who is a known con man. He's lived his entire career making false promises, set up what was supposed to be just the elite music festival on, I forget what island it was, and he got all these influences to say, oh, we're coming and we're doing this and we're doing that, and they were going to have, you know, high-end bungalows and this high-end food and just these, and he got behind. They were never going to make it. All the bands pulled out. Basically, all these people who paid $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 for these elite tickets showed up, and they were ending up having to stay in hurricane tents. There weren't enough mattresses.
Wow.
And the gourmet food ended up being a cheese sandwich with a slice of tomato because they ran out of money, because the guy didn't know what he was doing. And all these social media influencers basically, and it was like, oh, these models and this, we're going to be there. You're going to get to party with us by paying us all this money. And actually the funniest thing I saw was a guy who couldn't afford it. He won a ticket and he showed up and he's like, nothing is making my white middle-class heart sing more than watching all these rich entitled people go nuts over the fact that they're not going to be able to sleep on sticks. Like, people were hoarding mattresses against one another. It was about to become Lord of the Flies if it hadn't sort of, somebody hadn't stepped in, but it certainly shows that humanity is, you know, three meals away from anarchy if it gets right down to it. But the point of this being that these influencers that have enormous reach were like, yeah, because they were getting paid to say, if you get to come party with me, when they had no intention of showing up. I think that's my issue with all of this, is if you're going to do that and make some promise or claim and then renege on that and not provide what you promised, that gets in. I mean, I think the influencing thing is terrible, but it is just, I guess, a different kind of marketing. I mean, it's always been based on social proof of, I'm successful, I'm rich, I'm beautiful, I'm popular, you should do what I say. There is also the falsehood of it. It doesn't look like advertising anymore. Right, it was one thing when they used to show TV commercials and you knew it was an ad. Now it's people that are like, and they've done exposés. These people, they're like high-end Manhattan apartments or condominiums that are basically for rent to social media influencers for the day to go do a photo shoot to make it look like they're living this lifestyle of the rich and famous, and it's all bogus. not that. And so again, it's become, this is my life. This is how I'm truly living. And it's like, yeah, absolutely, you're not doing that. So yeah, like I can see kind of both sides of it, but it is becoming, I think, a real, real, real problem. I joked, remember about 2 weeks ago, Facebook and Instagram like stopped loading images.
Yeah.
Just for like a day. And of course my snarky comment was, and all of a sudden 50,000 social media Instagrammers lost their jobs.
Yeah.
Because that's it. Without the ability to post those kind of ridiculous pictures, that they basically, that's what their career is based on. So yeah, I mean, the fitness industry has been my passion professionally for 25 years now. God, that makes me sound old. You know, and it's been when I got into it, you know, 15, 16 years old, when, you know, that trite, your passion chooses you sort of thing. But it was true. When I started getting into it, it's just all I wanted to do. And I've watched it come and go. And as much as I love it some days of the week, man, there's parts of it that just make me wish I'd done something else. I don't know what. But I've joked that I should have sold drugs to high school kids, because drug dealers have ethics. And like, that's a bit of an exaggeration, and it's kind of a bit not, but this is an industry that has just since day one been based on false promises. And smokes was actually a book written, and it was something like Smoke and Mirrors, the fitness story, the history of the fitness industry. And it's just been based on BS from day one. And I guess the social media influencing is just the next evolution of that. But if you're going to make a promise, at least keep it. I mean, look at how many people have used stuff like GoFundMe and I forget what the other one is.
That's a bunch of them.
Yeah, to get a ton of money based on a promise and just disappear and just run away with the money, which is not only scummy, but then it also hurts the people that have a legitimate, it makes their, well, is this legitimate or not? Is this a legitimate something I want to fund, when it could just be another scumbag trying to rip me off? So yeah, that whole thing is just, let's just talk about how the world is going to hell in a handbasket, how it was better back in our day. Right, back in my day, in the 80s, when the economy was good and everything was fun, and my parents thought that my generation was ruined, and yeah.
I think most older, if you will, like generationally speaking, from one to the next, there's always this assumption that the up and coming generation is going to destroy everything. Right, they're gonna ruin everything and everything we built and everything we did. And the reality of it is, we all sort of survive. I mean. We heard this after the 2016 election, the end of the world was coming. And I said to a friend of mine, I said, look, it doesn't, you know, I've never cared who's president. I've never cared who's in Congress. The fact of the matter is that the nation will go on somehow, some way, in some form. So our industry will go on some way, somehow, some form. You know, I'm reminded, it's funny when you talked about form of advertising, I'm reminded of the original, and I want to say it was a Hydroxycut.
Uh-huh.
The 90s, when they got busted by the U.S., their USDA or the, I don't know, the FTC.
Yeah, whoever handles that.
They were taking before pictures. They were taking after, getting models fat, taking the after pictures first and the before pictures after they got fat, and paying them an enormous amount of money for this whole process. And it to me was just one of those things, like, if your product works, because apparently it did to a degree, if your product works, just let the product work.
Right. Yeah.
But let it tell us. Hurry. They needed to get this thing done right now. And it's easier to get somebody fat than it is to get them lean, right? I mean, we know that. And that's, for my listeners, in case you didn't know that, it's far easier to get fat in a shorter period of time.
Yeah,
so if you're looking to change your physique and you really want to do it quick, hit the buffet and don't worry about picking up weights. Anyway, so let me ask you this. What's really great in fitness right now? Like, what are you excited about in fitness right now?
That's a really good question. Actually, no. Actually, I say that is a fairly easy answer for me. And this will probably sound like pandering just because I wrote, but it's something I've watched, I think you've watched, over the decades, which is, especially in the strength sports, and here I'm talking, or even just the weight room in general, is the explosion of women in that activity.
Yeah,
right. I remember back in the 80s, and I mean, I've read the history in Title IX, and I did actually some historical analysis. It was really interesting of watching how women's involvement in sport evolved throughout the 20th century from being essentially 0% at the first Olympics, right? They basically and just tiny percentage. And then by the 50s and 60s, really, it was the Russians and the Germans really driving the bus. They were like, well, there's not a lot of women. We can win all the women's medals. The Russians actually pestered is the wrong word, but they tried to get the International Olympic Committee to put more women's events in so they had more medal opportunities, because that's actually what got the U.S. into the game, because this was an early Cold War, and the U.S. was like, okay, the Soviets and the Germans are winning all the women, because we don't have women's athletes, female athletes. We need to start promoting that, because otherwise we can't win on the global stage. And for people not familiar with the history of this, and this actually goes, one really fascinating documentary, there's a podcast about Hitler's Olympics, and he basically created the modern Olympics. He was the first one that was like, we're going to put on the biggest show in the world. We're going to basically, I mean, it was driven by the desire to promote Nazi ideology as the best, but he threw money and resources to basically make it look like something that it kind of wasn't. But so the U.S. realized we need to start promoting women's sports, because during the Cold War, the Olympics became the battleground for political ideology. Then in the late 70s, we got Title IX. And because even then there was the question, are women not going, are female, man, 2019 is tough. Are females not going into sport at any age because of a lack of interest or lack of availability? And with Title IX, the answer was made. Because from that point on, there was a linear increase in females in sport. It's a lack of availability. Men's sports didn't really, I had the numbers in something I'm working on now. The number of males and boys in sport, like at the high school level, didn't change over that time. And so boys stayed, and the interest in, so it was clearly availability. But it wasn't, I would say, the sports that women were latest, not to even necessarily be interested in per se, but to be allowed into were the strength sports, right? Bodybuilding was contested for men since the early 20th century. First female bodybuilding competition, like real bodybuilding, was in the 70s. Yep. First Mrs. Olympia was in the 80s. Jan Todd, Terry Todd's wife, was probably the first female powerlifter in the 70s, but she had to break through enormous number of barriers, and I suspect mainly it's because Terry was part of that sport. But when I used to take athletes to meets in the 90s, there, what was it, 90% men? Texas has an odd high school girls powerlifting tradition, because when you live out in the boonies of Texas, and there's a lot of boonies in Texas, what the hell else is there to do, really? And they got to deal with Texas boys, so I understood that one. But sure. Powerlifting at this point is almost approaching, I think it's 45% female athletes. Strongman, which at one point I think they called it female strongman, I believe it's now called strongwoman, has seen a dramatic increase in the number of women doing it. Olympic lifting, there's been an explosion. I mean, and to put this historically, men were competing in Olympic lifting in some form or fashion from about the year 1900. The first women's world championships, 1987.
Wow.
We were not allowed in the Olympics for weightlifting until the year 2000. We have had four total Olympiads with female Olympic lifters compared to a century for men. So there's a real, and I'm noticing, you know, it used to be the aerobics room was the purvey of women in the gym, and the weight room was the purvey of men. And women, I mean, frequently women who came into the weight room were either looked negatively at, were treated so badly that they left. Many gyms back in the day had a women's area. But even then, it was like the weights didn't go above 30 pounds because don't want to get bulky, don't want to have all that stuff, all that leftover just historical tradition. And that's falling by the wayside now, especially, you know, and honestly, like this takes us back to the Instagram thing and social media. Social media, I don't know. In hindsight, I don't know if it's a good thing. Like, it's done, like I was talking to my buddy earlier today, like, getting on Facebook is just low-level anxiety because all you see is the bad most of the time. Right. I only stay there because occasionally I see puppy videos. Like, it's that little bit of goodness that helps you realize that the world is not falling apart. And as much nonsense as it has contributed to the fitness industry, there has finally been such an increase in the number of female athletes that are lifting staggering weights, performing at the highest levels. And as much as I don't want to get into this topic, quote unquote, maintaining their femininity, right? And I want to be real clear about what I mean. Like, I'm not trying to impose typical male traditional definitions of that. Women listening to this know what I mean. The traditional like that was the fear. I don't want to get bulky. I don't want to become a, I don't want to lose my femininity. And seeing that, and then there's women who couldn't give the first damn, right? They don't want to, they're like, oh, if I want to be a strong, I want to compete in strong woman. And if that means a certain, I don't give a damn because I want to go host a yoke with 300 pounds on it because it's badass. That, that shift has been enormous. And we're at the point now, it can only keep going because once that, once the genie's out of the box on that one, there's no going back. And it's been phenomenal. I mean, there's a federation here in Texas, they have an all women's meet and it fills up. And 10 years ago, you couldn't do that because you'd only have 10 competitors show up. So I think that's probably the biggest change for the positive. And even in other populations, what you knew 30 years ago, what I knew 20 years ago, what researchers and medical people have finally realized that strength training is the key for all populations, all ages, to stay healthy and happy and functional later in life. Not that aerobic stuff isn't important, but the weight room is, and it's been a long time coming for that recognition to finally be made, not just in our little weird subculture, but when you are having, you know, premier news outlets going, yeah, strength training is the key to healthy aging. That's pretty exciting.
I happen to agree with you 100%. I think that is a great, it's one of the best trends that I've seen in our field, period, yeah, the entire time I've been in it. And to your point about femininity, and again, if I irritate some people, please understand, my point here is not, I'm not going to put my view of femininity on this whole topic, but here's the thing. Femininity is subjective, right? It's subjective on the part of the beholder, and yeah, it's subjective on the part of the woman, right? Her version of femininity may include being badass and carrying yokes and throwing balls. You know, that might be her version of femininity. How she's a strong woman is by being a strong human. And I think that's something that we should highlight that more when we're talking about this particular issue.
Agreed.
And let women dictate their own femininity. Right. And if we don't agree with it, well, too bad.
Yes, it's not about us. I mean, and that's the thing. Traditionally, it has been. It's about what was pleasing, you know, to, quote unquote, the male gaze. And that was what was driving a lot of this. There's actually a really interesting thing I found in doing some research. If you look at the, like, Miss America competitors over the last 10 or 15 years, there has been a gradual change in physique towards a more, you know, muscular tone. I'm not talking about bodybuilding. I'm not talking about, but there is a difference. We have gone from sort of that softer, skinny fat look, which was, you know, the ideal. There has been a gradual societal change. And I think that you bring a point I always like to clarify. This just increase in the strength sports, Olympic lifting, and in strong woman, exactly to your point, that is not how I'm defining success in the weight room either. Right. There is, I think, far more variability in both psychology and the body type of women, right? I've never met a male trainee who didn't want to go as heavy as possible, unless they were very much more. I'm 49 and I should know better because I tend to break more now. I still always have that mentality, just 5 more pounds, just a little bit more weight. There's still that, it never goes away. But for women, some women are just not psychologically drawn to that. Many women are, and I'm not saying either one is right or wrong.
Right.
It was something I saw in the 90s. There was sort of a very vocal group of women that got very into heavy lifting and heavy sets of fives and squats that thought that that's what weightlifting was, or more importantly, should be for women. And I disagree with that fundamentally. Some women just anatomically are not built for it. Their hip structure, their knees won't be happy with that. They may not be able to shoulder the weight on their upper body that their legs can move. If a particular woman, for her goal, her psychological needs, her biomechanical needs, if she wants to do a different sport, whether it's a physique sport, train to be healthy, to look and be happy, and train 12 to 15 reps and get strong there, That is completely valid, and which goes to your point. That is her definition to Meg. So please don't mishear me when I say, ah, women are going to be strength sports and they should all be doing that. Absolutely not what I'm saying. Just the general increase of women in the weight room, period, on any level, regardless of what they're doing, that's the biggest step change I think I've seen overall. That women are also, and I've also found with a lot of women when they get away from, you know, high rep, the stuff that, again, the media goes, oh, never lift over 3 pounds and all this other, when they start getting stronger, and I'm sure you've seen this, they get a little bit addicted to it. And I use the term addicted in a very colloquial sense. They love the fact that they feel strong. And I've seen many women transition from that lighter high to pushing themselves to go, huh, I want to see how strong I can get. And again, that's not right or wrong.
Right.
If that's a woman's choice, fantastic. If not, that's fantastic too.
Well, I think, you know, this strength training particularly, but fitness in general for women is and for men as well, right? It's self-actualizing. You start to realize what you're capable of. You start to realize what's in you and what you have. And for some people, and I have seen this over the years, the process of beginning to get stronger scares them a little bit, right? So in the beginning, they're a little bit afraid, like, well, what if I get too strong? What if I get too whatever, right? And you can kind of, and women, more women than men. I happen to agree with you. I think most men were dumb enough to think that we just need to do more, right? And I say dumb in quotes, right? But women, they're a little confused is the only word I can think of. It kind of throws them off a little bit in the very beginning, like, wow, this is getting easier for me, and I can move more weight. Now what, right? And wow. I think there's always going to be that momentary fear, if you will, that we can pretty easily get them over it as coaches, right? It's like, hey, listen, it's okay.
Yes.
No, it's okay. You're going to look great. You're going to be, you know, and then they can decide for themselves.
Sure.
It just gives them one more area, I think, for self-direction, self-decision. And they can decide for themselves which path they want to take in fitness, whether it's that power woman, that strong woman, powerlifting, lifting, whatever. They now have more choices because they're doing something that they were told years ago was not for them. And I think that's an outcropping of what you're talking about. And I think it's great.
Yeah. And just two more quick, I know we need to wrap up here, was one of the things I think, one, there is a biological aspect to men. It's testosterone. They've even shown that women with slightly higher testosterone pick more intense workouts. There's a biology to it, but there's also a huge sociocultural aspect to it. And because I remember the 80s, women were still being told, you know, you'll never get a man, your ovaries will fall out, you'll do reproductive damage, you'll end up looking like, because they were looking at, you know, very steroid abusing athletes, and that's what they thought the end result was. Even in the 90s, a wellness center I worked at, I had a woman get told by a physician, you do the Stairmaster, your ovaries will swell. And I'm just like, this is 50-year-old misunderstanding of when, I'm sure it was a male, but this, and then women who did try to enter even sport in general were generally looked very down upon. In the 70s and 80s, if a woman wanted to enter certain sports, especially, you know, the power sports, they were just de facto assumed to be gay. And it's very difficult. It's fantastic to go, you know, and true for male or female athletes, you can do whatever you want. Don't listen to anybody else and what they tell you. But when everybody is telling you and giving you nothing but negative feedback, you can't just say ignore that. It's easy to say, but it's impossible to do. And of course, it doesn't help. I've trained many female athletes. This is always my goal. I want them to scare the male lifters in the gym by using better technique, lifting heavy, heavy weights. I've had female athletes chase guys out of squat racks, away from bench presses, because they looked and went, I'm going to go somewhere where I'm not going to be quite as challenged. Men hate having that happen. So it was, and I mean, I've even seen now there's also a big increase in masters women's involvement. And I think that's huge. These are women that grew up back when you and I grew up being told, this is an inappropriate activity for women. This will hurt you. You should not be doing this. And they get into it. And it is, it's something that their moms told them. And you only know what you know. It was tradition. That's just what was done. And they get into it and realize there's nothing, they're getting nothing but accolades and support, and they love it. But the other thing I was going to say about men versus women, and this gets back to our early thing about the process, which we didn't really put explicitly, great athletes focus on the process. And the goal, the outcome will come of that. The goal will come out of that. They're either prepared or they're not, right? Life is not a Rocky movie as much as I wish it were. I mean, yeah, you have those winning on heart moments. But if you put in the work, you'll either get, like, the goal will happen, right? You'll either lift the weight or because you either were ready or weren't, like the lacrosse example. There's a skill they didn't have. That's because the process didn't give them that skill. And I remember reading years and years and years ago something to the effect that generally men are more goal-oriented, right? How do men select a weight in the weight room? It's whatever the last guy did plus 10 pounds.
Right.
Right? It's all about the goal. It's all about, I got to lift more. I got to outlift my buddy. And that gets real dangerous as we get older. My buddy Steve is as old as I am. He'll see some 22-year-old kids. He's like, I'm going to match him rep for rep. He can't walk for 2 weeks, but by God, he's not like, as 21. Men, we never get past
that. That's
all that matters, all right? Whereas women are frequently more process-oriented.
Agreed. Totally agree.
Whereas they will follow every instruction. They want to focus on the technique, on the process, but frequently to the exclusion of, and there's been a traditional thing where it's like women have not traditionally been as ferocious of competitors. Women are tend to be raised in what's called the web. It's about facilitating the social group to compete against another woman. To, you know, men, we just want to dominate. We want to own. Even a guy on a team wants to be the superstar, right? That guy, that one guy on the basketball team who wants to score every point. He wants to dominate the other team and his teammates. And I read this great article years ago, and it said the ideal was to, and again, this is totally sexist, but it's just a sort of a stereotypical description.
Don't sweat them out, I don't understand.
Train like a woman, compete like a man. And that's sort of like, the training is should be about the process. Do the process, you'll be ready for the competition, and the competition, give it your best. Which doesn't mean you can't be supportive of the other athletes. That's something I see in powerlifting, and especially in the women's only meets. Actually, it's true in general. If another lifter was better on that day, if they made the big lift, they deserve applause.
Absolutely. No
question. You lost, they were better. It is what it is. Next time, be better than them. Yeah. So yeah, I think that kind of brings us full circle. Getting women to stop being only process-oriented. But like you said, a good coach will bring that out. Go, let's just put a little more weight on the bar. And they feel a little bit stronger. And as they see the rewards and the successes, that becomes the self-propagating cycle.
And I'd love to see us be able to, you know, because I agree with you. I think men are more goal-oriented and women are more process-oriented.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of the reasons why fewer women will train through the pain of an injury. And more men are just you know, screw it. No pain, no gain, right? And they'll train through an injury and make it worse.
And I think not, women, not are, all. Smart. Not women all. Are just smarter, too. Yeah, that's a very macho thing, though.
It is a macho thing. But it's interesting. I think in light of this conversation,
yeah,
for the purposes of getting women from the process to the competition, right, having them understand that pushing through some discomfort isn't going to hurt your process, right, and it doesn't turn you into a man. It doesn't make you, an idiot, right? And on the part of men, slowing down and not, you know, not believing that pain is weakness leaving the body, that it's actually a signal of your brain asking you to fix what's in your body,
right,
so that you can do more, right? So those are sort of mediating and balancing things there that I think go together. But I love the way you express that, because I think you're absolutely right. Women can follow the process, and if we can just get them to be a little more competitive on game day,
right,
they're going to see more success and want to do more, I think.
And I think both of those basically come down, like almost in the same way, to that. That's the coach's job, is to work on the process to make sure that they get rewarded for being a little more goal. And it's little by little by little, so that you take female athletes to their competition, and they see that, okay, however you end up motivating them, and that's even a separate thing. Motivating men is very easy. You just call them a girl. I mean, it sounds trite and it's a little bit obnoxious, but that's traditionally been how you do it. Like, did you forget your purse today? By general experience, that type of motivation doesn't work with most women. Like, there are. I've met some women. I've had some female athletes that we just banged heads. The one I remember very specifically, she had been a boxer. I don't mean female. I don't mean like foxy boxing. I mean boxing. She was competitive as hell. I could challenge her by going, I bet you can't lift that. And she would do it. I mean, she would do it or die trying. And her training partner, who had just been beaten down by failure after failure after failure, I had to make sure she saw success for months. And I knew when I had her, because I would be like, you can go heavier. She's like, I can't do it. And one day, 6 months later, I go, you want to stay there or add weight? She just goes, put more weight on the bar. And I was like, gotcha. But it is. And with the male athletes going, look, what you're doing, you're going to competition, you're tired, you're exhausted, you're beaten up. Let's just back it up a little bit. If you'll just, and you may have to be a little autocratic, I think more so with the men, to stop them for, you know, so I tell my lifters, it's like, look, sometimes you got to keep it in your pants in the gym. Let's save it. Right. You just gotta, sometimes you gotta leave your ego at the door, and your male listeners know what I'm talking about there. And, but if you get them to focus on the process and suddenly go have their best competition by setting them up for success in either direction, that's how you start to change the mindset. And that's true. Like, this is everything we've talked about, motivation, not dedication so much, but going, look, if you put in the work, you'll get the benefits. You'll see the rewards. You'll get the accolades. That's how you bring, but that's a long-term process too. But a good coach, that's your job.
This has been if people, you know, for whoever listens to this or watches this, it may seem like we bounced around a lot of topics, but this is a very zen conversation. Like we kind of stayed around some very, yeah, you know, unifying themes. And I think that's, it's one of the things I think that comes from a lot of in the trenches experience and a lot of research and a lot of reading and a lot of being willing to be wrong sometimes. Right. I mean, that's
absolutely that
too few coaches are willing to do, but, thank you for this. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Love talking to you.
This is a happy hour Friday episode, however.
Oh yeah. Here we go again.
We do have a lightning round. Yep. I only have one question for you today, and I think you'll enjoy this one because you are an erudite individual with a broad broad base of experience. I'll ask the question, and after I ask the question, I'll give you 30 seconds to answer.
Okay.
And then we'll take it from there.
All right.
Here's the question. What is the best horrible movie you have ever seen, and why? And you know what I mean. Like Rotten Tomatoes horrible.
Yeah, the best horrible movie I've ever seen. And I've got so many guilty pleasure movies. I'm going to pull one a little bit. Possibly a little bit obscure. I was in very martial arts very heavily in my teens, and I'm obsessed about it as then. There's a movie called Only the Strong, and it was part of like I always love those 80s underdog against the bad guy training montage. I mean, Rocky created the mold, and they all came after that. And it is about the martial arts art capoeira. And capoeira is that Brazilian martial arts that looks, it's like halfway between dancing, break dancing, and martial arts. It's very, there's music behind it that sort of keeps the rhythm. And it was called Only the Strong. And it's about a capoeira master who comes back from the military, goes back to his old high school where all the kids are just, you know, dysfunctional rejects and involved in crime and this and that and the other. And he basically is going to save them through the art of capoeira. And he teaches them capoeira and builds confidence. And then of course, there's the evil drug dealer who's trying to impose on the school, who just conveniently happens to also be a capoeira expert, which is really...
How convenient is that?
I know, right? Almost like it was a terribly written plot. And so it's the typical thing. And we have the kid who's trying to break away from the drug dealer and the couple of sub fights, but it, you know, and the kids, their grades come up and the school suddenly supports it and everybody wins happily ever after. And the evil drug dealing martial arts guy gets defeated and embarrassed. And it ends with the kids putting on the capoeira show and roll credits and probably a song by Kenny Loggins, if I don't miss my guess, but like, it's not a good movie. But it is just one of those amazing guilty pleasures that I could watch all the time. They're just, I love those kinds of silly sports movies. So
there you go. Well, for you folks who are listening at home, I promise I will put a link, probably an Amazon link, so you can find Only the Strong and watch it for yourself. And then you can follow up with Lyle and let him know what you think. Lyle, this has been a lot of fun again. And
absolutely, Phil.
So glad Sumi hooked us up again. Tell my listeners and viewers how they can reach you if they want to, if they have questions, anything like that.
The website is bodyrecomposition.com. That's where all my articles are. That will take you to my store where I think I've got 14 or 15 books out right now. My Facebook group is really where I'm most active, bodyrecomposition.com. It's extremely active, and I always like to point out that I've got a lot of people in there. I tend to attract folks that are experts in their individual fields. I have three or four great physiotherapists, a couple of physicians, a fantastic OBGYN. Like, it never ceases to amaze me. Any topic that is asked about that I don't know anything about, which is quite common. I'm somewhat of a generalist, but there's a lot of stuff. Somebody will have an answer. They'll either be in the field, experienced it, and I learn constantly from the people in my group. So my Facebook group, and I'm there daily. We post research articles. I'll put up technique videos and all kinds of random stuff. So that's probably the best place to find me overall.
I can vouch for that group. It is a lot of fun, and there are some super smart people in there, and I learn something almost every day. So definitely appreciate that. Well, for those of you listening at home, I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the podcast. And my listeners, if you're listening on iTunes, you do me a favor. If you like this interview, drop me a 5-star rating, leave a comment, let people know there's some value to be had here. And in any case, again, thank you for listening. And I just want you to keep the faith and keep after it. We'll be right back.